Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, our weekly mix of great science and music. I'm Jorge Salazar. Here's a scientist soundbite.
You know, it was not my goal to go kill the planet Pluto. My goal when I started out doing my search of the outer solar system was to find a 10th planet because, you know, I knew, like everybody knows, that if you find something bigger than Pluto, that it's going to be called a planet. But as I was doing the search and as we were finding more and more things the size of Pluto, it became quite apparent that Pluto really didn't occupy this special place in the solar system. It was just one of many other things like it. And that's really why Pluto had to be demoted back to its rightful place as part of this debris field outside of Neptune.
That was astronomer Mike Brown with the California Institute of Technology. His discovery of dwarf planet Eris in 2005 ultimately led astronomers to rethink what defines a planet and to demote Pluto. More with him later. Today on Weird Science, Ryan Britton brings us a weird story, and this goes down as a really weird story, about increasing in vitro fertilization success with the use of humor and medical clowns. Ryan, clowns, really?
Today I have a story about clowns. Oftentimes when a woman is having trouble getting pregnant, she can undergo an in vitro fertilization or an IVF procedure in hopes of getting pregnant. But IVF is an expensive procedure where fertilized embryos are implanted directly in the uterus of a woman. So it's a high-stakes procedure for a woman that can be, you know, very stressful, very emotional.
For relief, bring in the clowns.
Apparently, yes. Israeli researchers did a study and found that 36% of women undergoing IVF became pregnant after they were entertained by a professional medical clown. This is in comparison to the just 20% that became pregnant without getting to laugh with a clown or you know, sort of having a comedy-less procedure. So that's a 16% increase, and that's significant, especially when you consider how expensive in vitro fertilization is.
The positive effects of laughter.
That's right. Laughter is a natural anti-stress mechanism, and less stress is good when it comes to in vitro. So it makes sense. But the weird part for me is the clowns themselves. I had the question of who are medical clowns? Where do you find a medical clown? In the study, they're described as professionals, and it turns out that there is a real program at the Department of Theater at the University of Haifa. These medical clowns take specially designed courses in the field of nursing to provide them with skills that will enable them to integrate into hospitals. So here you have clowns in hospitals.
So medical clowning to help patients recover.
That's right. And you can find more information about this story at reutershealth.com. But before I go, I wanted to give you an update on a previous weird science story. Last month, I reported on Wafa Bilal, who's an artist and professor at New York University, and he had a camera implanted in the back of his head for an art project called The Third Eye. So the idea is to have people witness his daily life and the things that he, quote-unquote, leaves behind, so to speak.
So what happened to this guy's camera at the back of his head?
Well, his body rejected the camera, and he was in constant pain, so the camera was removed. This idea of melding man and machine in a new way, you know, hit a snafu, but according to Bilal, the art project goes on. He's wearing a camera strapped to his head until his wounds heal and he can have a new camera reinstalled.
So he will not be assimilated yet.
No, not yet. So you can find more information about this art project at www.thirdeye.me, and that's spelled 3RDI.ME.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
True as day comes and cruel.
Emily Howard joins us in the studio now to talk about bees, bee pastures, and growing almonds. Emily, what's happening here?
Bee populations have been in dramatic and mysterious decline for the past few years. And one thing that scientists are thinking could counter this decline is bee pastures. Now, what those are these meadows of wildflowers that are inserted into these singular crop systems, these farms that say only are growing almonds or only growing peaches. So these bee pastures, they extend the supply of food for bees and thereby extend the bees' reproductive time. Here's Jim Kane to explain more.
The problem in most monoculture crops, not all, but most, many, like almonds, is bloom is relatively brief relative to the 4 to 5 week lifespan of the individual female bee. So we're trying to extend a suitable blooming period beyond, say, almond bloom, so that these females can lay more eggs, produce more progeny, and thereby be sustainably managed. So what we're doing is between the end of bloom on the almonds in late February, sometime in March, and when they harvest, we're going to insert small patches of these annual wildflowers to feed the blue orchard bees that are in that orchard through the rest of March and maybe into early April, and thereby squeeze out more reproduction.
So Emily, Jim Kane is with the USDA, and he is basically concerned with trying to get farmers to, or helping farmers, grow more almonds using these pastures of wildflowers for bees. He studied this. What did he find out?
Well, he's had great results. Here's Dr. Kane.
And we found that we could have a dramatic increase in the number of bees, more than a five-fold increase. So for every mother bee we put in there, we got back five or more daughters for each female. So that's a huge increase. That's considering they produce more sons than daughters, that's a big increase. We're very pleased with it.
So pastures of wildflowers are not only good for bees, they're good for almonds.
That's correct.
Thanks, Emily.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Emily Howard, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Up next, astronomer Mike Brown, who's written a book called How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. Dr. Brown, welcome back to Earth Sky.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
So just get right to it. So why did you kill the planet Pluto?
You know, it was not my goal to go kill the planet Pluto. My goal when I started out doing my search of the outer solar system was to find a 10th planet because, you know, I knew, like everybody knows, that if you find something bigger than Pluto, that it's going to be called a planet. But as I was doing the search and as we were finding more and more things the size of Pluto, it became quite apparent that Pluto really didn't occupy this special place in the solar system. It was just one of many other things like it. And that's really why Pluto had to be demoted back to its rightful place as part of this debris field outside of Neptune. Hmm.
And I'm sure you've read your hate mail in killing the planet Pluto. But Pluto as a planet has had a lot going for it. It was beloved by children and adults as a kind of little planet that could. In your book, you write about your family life and why that was important and relevant to your decision to kill planet Pluto. Tell us more about that.
You know, there was a moment that I talk about in the book where I had to decide what I was going to say about Pluto and how I was going to try to feel about not just Pluto but about the discoveries I'd made of Eris, the object that's more massive than Pluto. And I sat out on this beach on this island up in the San Juan Islands and just to think about what to call it. And I remember going back to my wife at that point and again writing about this in the book where I having talked with her about it and trying to explain things to my daughter, who was very young then at the time, I realized that it, even though it would have been very nice to have been able to say that I had discovered this 10th planet by finding the thing more massive than Pluto, that to be honest with myself and to be honest with, as I was looking at it, to be honest with my wife and my daughter, I had to admit to them and to the world that really these discoveries were not showing us new planets, that these discoveries were showing us that that really there were only eight, and that all of these things that were being found out there are all sort of more or less the same. No one of them really sticks out, and that it makes much more sense to call the eight big ones planets and to call all the rest of that debris just something else.
Yeah, maybe we could talk about some of this debris out in the outer limits of our solar system. And you've discovered hundreds of objects beyond the orbit of the planet Neptune, including the object that killed Pluto, in a sense. In a nutshell, what work goes into discovering those tiny worlds out there? How do you do it?
In a sense, discovering these things is conceptually very simple. Everything in the solar system moves. It goes around the sun and is relatively close by compared to the stars that are much further away. So when you look up in the sky, all the stars and all the galaxies are in the same fixed positions night after night after night. And anything in the solar system moves across the sky. If the thing in the solar system is close to you, like the moon or even a meteor shooting through the atmosphere or something, it moves very quickly. And if a thing in the solar system is far away, like something out beyond Neptune, it moves very slowly. So all we really do to find these things is take a picture of the sky and come back an hour later, take another picture of the sky, and then simply look for anything that moves. It's the same thing that was done by Clyde Tombaugh to find Pluto. He would take a big photographic plate of the sky, come back the next day, take another photographic plate, and look for that one thing that moves. So conceptually, it's relatively simple. The difficulty is that the technical difficulty is that since we didn't know where in the sky these things were for which we were looking, we basically had to cover the whole sky. And that's a daunting task. The sky is a huge place if you want to take very highly magnified pictures of the whole thing.
You know, in thinking about it, I was thinking about the title of your book, How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. I mean, that raises a lot of questions just right there. Maybe I could get you to maybe explain a little bit more about why the planet Pluto, why it had it coming, why it needed to be demoted, in your opinion.
Having this classification that we now have, realizing that the solar system consists of eight very large dominant things that define the solar system. They are the architecture of the solar system. It's these eight dominant objects that are then surrounded by little bits of debris that are going in and out of the orbits of these dominant objects that are the planets. And it's that realization that led to the demotion of Pluto, the realization that Pluto is not this unique object in the solar system in the way that the eight planets are. It's really part of this whole field of debris. And I think a lot of people have the wrong impression of Pluto because of the sort of images of the solar system that we're often presented with. I've really gotten to know this well in the last couple of years as I see the things that people give to my daughter because they think it's funny to give her things that have Pluto as a planet on them. and you see these images of the solar system where there are nine planets that are more or less the same size. You see Jupiter is a little bit bigger than the Earth, and the Earth is a little bit bigger than Mercury, and Mercury and Pluto are about the same size, and there are nine of these big bodies in the solar system. And that view of the solar system is thoroughly incorrect. It's just not the way the solar system really looks. And if the solar system did look that way, even I would think that demoting Pluto didn't make sense. But I think that a lot of people think that that is the solar system. The real view of the solar system is Jupiter is huge compared to anything else out there. The Earth is much, much smaller than Jupiter, and Pluto is even tinier still. It's half the size of our own moon. And getting that correct impression of what the solar system is really like out and having people really understand what the universe around them looks like, the real solar system instead of the cartoon solar system, I think is an incredibly important part of astronomers trying to educate the public. So I think not only did Pluto have it coming in the sense that it never was this big, important part of the solar system, but it actually matters a lot. It matters that we explain this to the public. We educate people on what their universe is actually like.
Thinking back, did you ever consider, like, you know, maybe I want to be on the Pluto side. I want to be on the 10th planet side as opposed to the 8th planet side?
But at first I thought, okay, it doesn't matter. If Pluto's going to be a planet, Eris can be a planet, there can be 10 planets, and we don't really need a scientific definition of the word planet. I mean, to have Pluto and Eris be called planets, you just have to give up on science and just say, well, we call them planets because planet doesn't really mean anything, and that's what we want them to be. It's kind of like the word continent. The word continent doesn't actually mean anything. It's just continents are the things that we say they are, and planets could be the same way. And that was okay. It would mean that I got to have discovered the 10th planet. That seemed like an okay thing to me. And it would mean that there was no good scientific definition of the word planet, and that didn't seem so good. But I didn't think there was any other good solution. In the end, when astronomers started grumbling about some of the proposed definitions and finally got together and considered basically kicking Pluto out, or actually kicking the one I had discovered, Eris, out, and Pluto along with it, when it became clear that astronomers really were going to try to get together and actually have the determination to do this, I was thrilled. Even though I lost Eris as the 10th planet, I suddenly realized that we had an opportunity to actually make a scientific definition of the word planet that described the solar system correctly. And it's such a beautiful thing. The solar system is arranged in such a beautiful way with these eight dominant things and everything else flitting around between them, that if we can have our cultural view of what the solar system is, which is really enshrined in the word planet, if we can have that cultural view mesh with the scientific view, I would gladly trade my discovery of a 10th planet for really furthering the overall world's understanding of how the solar system is. So I'm very happy with the way it worked out. I would never have guessed that it would have happened, because I really just didn't think that astronomers would be organized enough to get together and do it. But I am, as I said, I'm really thrilled that they did.
Well, Dr. Brown, thank you for speaking with us. Today's my final question. What's the most important thing you want people today to know about Pluto?
I would say the most important thing to know about Pluto is that in the scale of the solar system, it is insignificant debris. And I say that fondly. It sounds like something I would say to be mean. It's insignificant debris in the same sense that all of those things that I have discovered in the solar system are insignificant debris. On the scale of the solar system, while the eight planets dominate everything that goes on, Pluto and all the other things like Pluto are simply dominated by these eight planets. They're kicked around. They're on these crazy elliptical orbits and tilted orbits, whereas the planets are on these nice, stately, orderly orbits on the inside. And so I think that's the important thing to remember about Pluto. It's not this special planetary class object out past Neptune. It's just one of many, many things like it that is in that grand scale of the solar system, just a little speck of debris.
That was astronomer Mike Brown of Caltech. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, The Black and White Years, The Bright Light Social Hour, The Sour Notes, and Box of Baby Birds. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.